G'day everybody, Aaron Noonan here. Welcome again to the V8 Sleuth podcast powered by Repco. My guest on this episode is none other than the two-time Supercars champion and recent GRM signing, Marcus Ambrose. We talk on this pod about, well, a bunch of stuff. We talk about his new role at GRM. In fact, we caught up at GRM. We talk about how it came to be and how it came to be that he ended up on a Supercars TV broadcast desk alongside Mark Scaife and Neil Crompton. We talk about racing Formula Ford in Australia and also in England, how his first drive of a V8 supercar came to be in a Commodore. Sorry, Ford fans, it wasn't a Holden. We talk about Bathurst 2000, not because he was in the race. It's about something that was going on in the garage at Stone Brothers that you need to know about. He tells plenty of stories from his glory years at Stone Brothers Racing, and he tackles a couple of our segments. What's in your cupboard, with thanks to our mates at the Motorsport Trader and the National Motor Racing Museum's Couch Racer Questions. You'll hear a bit of a V8 engine noise in the background towards the end of this chat as well. We're in the meeting room at Gary Rogers Motorsport upstairs, but there's so much work going on at GRM with all of their race car programs that you just expect a racing engine to fire up at some point. So it adds a bit of ambiance, I reckon, to this whole chat with Marcus. It was great to catch up with him. We caught up at GRM, as I mentioned. So here we go. Buckle up. Time to start. Marcus Ambrose on the V8 Sleuth podcast, powered by Repco. Marcus Ambrose, welcome to the V8 Sleuth podcast. We are sitting in the meeting room of Gary Rogers Motorsport. I never thought I'd do a pod with you here. This is different.
Well, I've actually worked out who the sleuth is.
It's taken a while, but we got there eventually. We got there eventually. Mate, thanks for the time. Really appreciate it. There's so much to talk about. We'll try to jam as much of it as we can in, but I guess we should start in the now. So we're sitting at GRM. We should talk about this. What's your job title? What are you here?
Well, before I start about me, this is my first ever podcast. So I retired before podcasting took hold. So look at the last five, six years. Look at what happens, eh? So yeah, you're my very first official podcast. Privileged. I've done Rusty's Garage, but that was at home, not official setting.
Unofficially official.
Yeah, so this is the first official one we've got. My role here at GRM is actually a really exciting one. So I've sort of popped my head back up into motorsport. I've got my two girls who like go-karting. They got me back to the track.
And then
Owen Kelly comes along. He says, hey, I've got this thing going where I want to do some Trans Am races in Tassie over Christmas, which was, you know, what we've just been through at the start of this year, the Simmons Plains and Baskerville double header. He said, can you give me a hand? Turn some wrenches, just, you know, all the old mates get back together again. And Adam Gowns and Dwayne Priest, my friends from Tassie, you know, came along. And, yeah, that was great. And here we are.
Still going.
8 months later, still going. So Owen got the bug. You know, he ran really well in the Trans Am. He likes the class. I like working on the car. It's a great class to work inside of. It's a fun community inside the Trans Am garage area. The cars are fun to drive. They're fun to work on. The racing's, you know, high quality. So I was happy to help Owen go along, and he happened to be working out of GRM. And so then Gary and Barry, you know, saw what I was up to, and we had a few chats, and just, you know, one thing leads to another, and here we are. But my official role is really competition director, and that's a pretty vague term. We don't do titles here at GRM. Mm. Gary's pretty.
But have you got a nickname?
Pretty
clear. Because they do nicknames at GRM.
Not that I know of yet, but I'm sure I've got one.
Give it time. He'll be on it. Don't worry.
I know I've had one here in the past.
When you didn't drive for him.
But so my role here is really to support the drivers, to support the mechanics and the engineers and everyone that works, you know, in the workshop, basically, is a bit of a conduit between the front office and the workshop to get back into a winning ways. Mm. GRM have changed a lot since they stepped out of V8 Supercar. They took on the S5000 program and did an incredible job to turn what was an idea into reality. And so that's taken a lot of brain power, a lot of prototyping, a lot of machine specialized parts, a lot of, you know, unique to Australia stuff they've done to get those cars on the track. And then they've sort of embraced the TCR side of things inside ARG, and so they've really focused on supporting that category heavily, and they've got 7 race cars in TCR this year, and then Owen and a couple other guys have driven Trans Ams from time to time. So
it's a full workshop.
It's a full on program.
There's no way to move down here. Like, yeah, there's stuff everywhere.
And part of me coming in is actually to look at everything that's going on and saying, okay, you know, this is GRM today. This is you know, they got here for various reasons, but they want to, you know, refocus on being a race team and winning. And so my element inside this bigger JRM organisation is to reform the race team and get the pizzazz back and get some mojo and go out there and try and, you know, improve the competition side of the company.
So this time last year, if someone had said, come and be the competition director of a major race team and do some television analyst stuff on supercars, you probably would have thought they were crazy. Or is this falling you back into the motorsport sphere? Because I feel like you came back, the DJR thing ended, and you've gone off and done all the other things. You're a man of your own trail. You've always been that way. Mm-hmm. It's one of the things that I think is amazingly great about you in a sport where conforming is kind of the norm. And now it's like the lure of the old love of motorsport comes back. So where did this come from? Is it just naturally evolved? Could you feel it as a dedicated decision in your brain to go, I'm coming back to do some stuff here?
Well, I never fell out of love with motorsport. Like, I love racing. I'm a historian to some degree of racing. I like,
you should come and work at our place.
Following the old stuff. Yep. And I love dirt speedway. I love the USAC stuff over in the States. I love Outlaws. I love the NASCAR. You know, I'm a fan of racing and races. And so I was really happy to step in, you know, at JRM because Gary Rogers, like him or not, he's a racer and he has put a race team on the track for decades. Mm. And he's given young guys a shot and he's given them plenty of chances to turn into professional drivers, you know, Buck Warner and Tanner, the list goes on, Scotty McLaughlin, you know, list goes on. So he's put his money where his mouth is and he's delivered results over the years and he's a real racer's racer. So I've got a lot of time and respect for everybody at JRM because it starts from the top, Gary down, and now Barry's involved and Barry's a great guy, loves his sport, you know, fantastic deal. So was I dragged kicking and screaming? No. I'm just happy to be here now in this place and helping where I can. Mm. So it was time for me to get out of the race car. So, you know, that's what happened back in the DJR Penske deal. And so it was just time to stop. I knew it, refocus on family, refocus on myself, you know, get all that sorted out. Done that. Everything's great. Family's great. Life's good. And so now, you know, with the COVID thing happening and just sort of naturally sort of getting re-engaged in motorsport through Owen and my kids and so forth, you know, I'm energized by the community. It's a great space. They're all can-do people in motorsport. And that's really good to be around those kind of people. And, you know, we're going to the track, we're traveling, even though it's a bit hard this year with COVID. But, you know, you're moving around the country. And so I'm re-energized to be part of the motorsport, you know, family again, if you like. And I'm really happy to play my role now, which is actually using my skills and experience and knowledge, whatever it is, whatever it's worth, over time to help the next wave. And so I'm helping Barry and Gary where I can. And I'm going to help the drivers and the mechanics where I can. But, you know, and if I've got a role to play that I can contribute, that's fantastic. And I'm happy to pass that knowledge along.
Can you see a pathway down the track? Probably haven't even had time to stop and think about it because there's so much going on in this place. But team ownership, having a slice of the pie, a bit of equity, or doing something a bit beyond that, as a case of there's so much to do right now, let's just work on this now.
No, none of that's crossed my mind. That's not where I'm at. I'm actually sort of overwhelmed with the amount of work to be done here. So I'm sort of – I've bitten off a fair bit already and I know it. And so I'm really happy to say, okay, I'm going to stay in my lane on this one. You know, we've got an incredible opportunity here at JRM to make things better, to go out there and win races, have a good time, help junior drivers get through, help professional drivers stay in the business, help sponsors get value. So there's lots of great things to be done right here, right now, and that's really what I've – that's what I'm only focused on.
There's a few people who probably thought hell had frozen over when they turned on their broadcast at Simmons Plains of supercars to find M. Ambrose and M. Scaife sitting on a panel smiling next to one another. A lot of people were, Marcus on TV, this is weird, this is what, huh? But I totally got, and then people were surprised that you did a great job. Mm. There's no surprise here. Mm. You've been there and done it. You've been in the most media-focused part of the world in North America, in the most public profile series in the world for 10 years. So it's not like you don't know how to talk in front of a camera or do stuff, but bringing the guy who's not been in the paddock for some time now, fresh eyes, did you enjoy it? Did you enjoy it more than you thought? Did you have to be kind of convinced to do it? How did that all come together?
Well, again, it was just a circumstance kind of thing. I lived in Tasmania. There was a spot at some
spines
that needed to be filled. Nathan Prendergast gives me a call. Hey, you know, would you mind filling in? Yeah, sure. I'm kicking around. That's no problem. We can go do that. I had very low expectations going in of like what it was going to be. I underestimated actually the intensity of a live broadcast. So that's the first thing. I've been exposed to media. I've been exposed to the TV camera, but not from that side. I've always been interviewed, not an interviewee. And so, you know, I really enjoyed the weekend of that. It was actually, you know, invigorating again. It was pretty dynamic and you're thinking on the fly and you, you know, if you say the wrong thing, you're going to be in trouble. So you got a little bit of pressure on your shoulders. And I don't, you know, I've been out of the motorsport game for a while as far as being at the track and so forth, but I'm still engaged.
You know, you're still watching. You still know who's
you are. I mean, you know, everyone does. I'm sure Pat Rafter watches games of tennis, you know, from time to time. It's just how it is. And so, yeah, I'm engaged to it. And so I just tried to, on that weekend at Simmons Plains, I just tried to talk about what I did know and stay away from what I didn't know. And what I do know is how a driver thinks and the pressures of the weekend and expectations and over the course of the weekend how things go. And from a driver's perspective, I can talk about that. And I've got the unique angle too of being outside the sport for a long time. I've been watching it. I've been seeing it. I see what the fans see. And so I was able to bring some of that element to it as well. In balance, you know, you can't be a raving fan behind the microphone, can you? But there is a balance there to be struck. And so I've actually – it's pretty cool because I get to see it from all sides now. I'm seeing it from the TV perspective and inside the sport. I'm seeing it as a competitor and I'm seeing it as a fan.
It's really cool. It's something that we look forward to seeing you do some – Bathurst?
At this stage, Bathurst and Gold Coast.
Gold Coast.
Yep.
Final round of the championship, place that you went all right in the past as well, disqualify. I want to rewind. That's what we kind of do in our little world of V8 Sleuth here. We go back over the stuff that people probably couldn't talk about back in the day, but they can now because enough time's passed that they won't get sued. No, not get sued, but you know what I mean. As a young bloke, 1997 was the first year I turned up at a motor race for Motorsport News magazine. It's not around anymore. The first round of the national championship for Formula Ford was at Calder, you might remember, under lights, the first V8 supercar branded round. I think Wayne Gardner won in the Coke car. The first bloke I met that weekend as the Cub reporter at age 16 was Garth Tander.
Wow.
The second bloke was sitting alongside from the table here now. And I think the third bloke was Todd Kelly, from my memory. He was part of the crew that year in Formula Ford.
Tough crowd.
They all went on to do some stuff in the years that followed. But I haven't heard many people ask you about 1997, kind of that year of – you'd been in Formula Ford in 96 in a Swift, I think, from
it was,
memory.
Yep.
Then you're in the VD and it had the Valvoline sponsorship.
It did.
So there's
Gary Rogers
connection from back in the day, which a lot of people forget.
That's right.
Tell me about that year. I mean, I know Tander won the championship, but it was a tightly run thing all year.
Yeah, look, I'm a Tasmanian born and bred guy, so my first year of car racing – you know, it was 96 and I moved myself to Melbourne. We did the Swift Formula Ford. We started.
It was a shocking purple thing, wasn't it?
No, it was blue. It was an ugly blue.
Oh,
okay.
Yeah. Oh, geez, it was very ugly blue.
But Ray Cutchie got us started in that and then we went off and sort of did our own thing with Neil McCauley just around the corner here at Moorabbin. And so we had a year there and it was really sort of a year of not really any expectations at all and probably overachieved. I look back now and I was very green, probably shouldn't have gone straight to national series. Probably should have
State series
and so forth. And so then, you know, all of a sudden the gun ride was the Van Diemen factory drive.
And if you got the Valvoline money.
Yeah, Valvoline and Bob Jane Teammates attached to it. It was a pretty cool deal. And so Harry Galloway from Sydney was running that with David Bernard the year before.
Yep.
So and David's a real hot shoe, like just such a talent. And especially in those junior categories, he was so fast. So you know, big shoes to fill. So I went up there and moved to Sydney for 97. Our first race was at Calder Park, just on Calder Park. My very first ever race car experience was at Calder Park with the Swift Formula Ford in drizzly rain.
Uh-oh.
And that track's long, isn't
it? Big straight.
You know, big, long straight. And you go over the hump and down the hill away from the pits. And I spun out the first corner, second corner, third corner.
On the one lap?
On the outlap.
Oh, I thought you were going to say on successive laps.
No, on the outlap. So I spun three times, three corners, got up over the hump, and no one saw a thing.
But they wondered why it took 4 minutes to come
around. Yeah, they did. Maybe I was, whatever. But so Calder Park, you know, what a throwback track that is. I just, you know, I really enjoy my races there. Very narrow track, really,
yeah.
Modern standards, but always put on a pretty exciting show. And, yeah, fun times there for sure. But that first year, was tough. In Formula Ford, the second year was tougher. Garth Tanner was, he beat me. That's for sure. But it was neck and neck really all the way to the wire.
In that era where Formula Ford, the crop each year, was the place where you look to. That and Formula Holden were kind of the stepping stones. But the class of Formula Ford of each year, probably up till about the early 2000s when it was around for some time, but it probably wasn't having guys getting the same impact coming through because there were more choices. You go Development Series or Carrera Cup or there were other places to go. But that class that year was pretty impressive.
Well, let's go back to 97. I mean, that was the first year of V8 Supercars and Cochrane officially. Yeah. I remember going to Sandown for the 500 and this guy called Tony Cochrane
built
a tent. Yeah, I said, oh, we're going to crack
this. No sacred sites, I believe the term was.
That's right. We're going to crack this thing. It's going to be called V8 Supercars. It's going to be bigger than Ben-Hur and we're going to do this and we're going to do that. And I'm like, who is this bozo?
I don't think you're the only one thinking that. But
okay. Look what happened, mate. Amazing story. Yeah. Amazing story. And it went. And really that first year, 97, cracker. And then it went all the way through really to the mid-2000s, I think. It just – what a wave motorsport was on at that period of time. So there was a lot of fanfare, a lot of excitement. Sellout crowds. I mean, I just remember racing at Iron Park and it was just bumper to bumper. I mean, it was just a huge crowd there on the day. Wanneroo was the same. Just what a fantastic time to grow up and be part of motor racing. That era was really a golden era.
Yeah, and it feels like yesterday, but it's long enough ago that you go, actually, wow, that's actually not exactly yesterday. It's passed a little bit of time since then. But 97 is an interesting one because, and you said Sandown. I thought you talked about the 500, but at the touring car round, not many people remember. You practiced the Elcare car on the Friday because Stephen Johnson was delayed to come. He was driving that car as a privateer. But you'd had a bit of a drive of that at Tassie, I think, maybe the year before with Greg Crick, who was sort of tied up in a lot. That's your first. And the reason why I preface that is you were kind enough to give some time recently to talk about that. We're doing our Perkins Engineering car history book, 50-odd cars that Larry's team built over the years. That was one of them. It was a customer car. And it gave you your first V8 supercar drive.
Yep, that's right.
Were you going to do the Enduros and then you went to Formula Ford festivals and stuff like that? Was on the table maybe?
Yeah, look.
Potentially?
It puts hairs on the back of my neck up because it's just such a great memory, isn't it? Like Greg Crick,
Ripper.
He's still involved with GRM today, so there's your full circle back.
Yeah, wherever you go, you can't get away from
him. That's what the motorsport community is all about, right?
Yeah. And so, he managed for Geelong, though. That's the only problem about
there you go.
Cricky. It's terrible.
And so there was a test they were doing at Simmons Plains. This was back in March-ish, I guess. It was sort of tail end of the summer in Tasmania. They had the car down there and Greg, invited me or made it happen that I could come up there and do a few laps, did about 10, 15 laps or whatever. And it was one of the last V8 supercars with no power steering.
Oh.
So I'm trying to turn this thing at the hairpin at Simmons Plains and what is going on here? Like how incredible is Dick Johnson to be able to drive these cars? Well, as a bit of a noob, I didn't realize it was the only car in the field with no power steering. And so that sort of started things off with John. And, we were talking about, doing some endurance races. But again, so green. I probably wasn't ready. We were on that Formula Ford path and it sort of clashed with the festival. We decided to go over and have a shot at the Formula Ford Festival and some other races there. And that's kind of where it led to. Never got a chance to come back because after that I went over to Europe in 98, 99, 2000. So sort of I had to wait a bit longer to get back to V8s.
You got there eventually. It took a little bit longer to come back. It reminds me too of a little story that we started telling it when we were off air before we started this, but you went to England in 98 to race the British Formula Ford Championship, which at the time was a stonking championship.
Teammate was Danny Weldon, by the way.
Yeah, Dan Weldon, the late great Dan Weldon, Indy 500 winner twice over. It was Daniel Weldon back then.
It was.
They didn't call him Dan until he kind of got – in America, they just shorten your name, really, don't they? Alessandro Zanardi, Alex Zanardi. Yeah. One Pablo Montoya, one Montoya. Yeah. They just don't like to let it go too long.
And the champion that year was Jenson Button.
So he worked out all right too.
So I've always been up against some pretty stiff competition all the way through.
Yeah, absolutely. But do you recall in 1998, this is before we had Twitter and social media and email that flew around the world quickly and mobile phones, your website. I remember this well.
Is this a self-plug?
No, it's not a self-plug. It's just an interesting story that the Sleuth and Ambrose connection that people don't really know about. But it's more about how technology's changed. So you went to England. I can't remember how it happened. I think you asked me. I asked you, whatever.
I think I found you and asked you.
I need to do a website. Yeah. And at the time, 1998, a website. Oh, that's a bit, that's pretty high tech. I I could write. My mate Tim Bigarelli, I'll give him a plug now from school in Ballarat. He's the IT guy, still is, established a great career in that line of work. He said, yeah, we can do this. We'll make it. But it's not like today where you could just fire up a tweet, send a thing. So how it would, I don't know if you could remember this, but the fax would come out.
Yeah, I remember.
From the UK, from whoever was writing it
I was writing the race report.
I did really – Ambrose did well this today, Brands Hatch. It had come out. We didn't have a fax machine at home, so I gave you my mum's office number.
There you go.
She would pick it up on a Monday, bring it
there
home. I'd type
there
it, give
go.
It to my mate. It would get on the website Tuesday afternoon. We did that for a whole year.
But you know what? That's actually what got me, you know, my opportunities when I came back to Australia. So part of the push for that was not that I was breaking new ground, but you know, I had ties to Australia. I was trying to become a professional driver. I just knew that I needed to sort of stand out. Carl Edwards, NASCAR champion in the States, he used to put advertisements in the race papers saying, you know, I'm here, hire me. Some guys think differently, right? And so all
Any
I was trying to do was stay connected and stay known in the Australian motor racing community, because I knew that the chances of making a career of it in Europe were slim, but it was like my university. So I was going to Europe to learn the craft, to learn how to race against the best, to see how it went, see where it went, see what happened, but at the same time, create a bit of a fallback strategy. And my fallback was, hey, this Tony Cochran guy, like 97, that was a – I mean, what that V8 supercar thing, that's pretty cool. Those cars are pretty cool. And I kind of remembered some of those guys got paid.
And so I was money too.
Yeah, well, you've got to – I mean, at the end of the day,
yeah,
you know, you can't race for free at the professional level because you've got to put food on the table.
Yeah.
So my goal was to become a professional driver, and really my – tick in the box was that, do I get paid? You know, because that's when you actually become a professional.
Yeah.
And so I always had that in the back of my mind to say, you know, don't forget about Australia. Stay connected down there where you can. That's where the whole idea of doing the race report, having a website, getting it out to the team owners, I kind of knew that that's where it was going. And I'm 44 now. So my first experience with the internet was to catch a bus from Launceston College in grade 11 and drive to the Maritime College to go into a giant room with a giant computer and one screen and look at the internet.
You have to book 10-minute slots. And
it doesn't take you long to work out what a bunch of young Launceston schoolboys want to look at on the internet.
Race cars, Marcus.
We pretty much
stuff.
Got to where the internet's got to in the first 3 minutes. And so, yeah, Tasmanian guy, you know, not really tech savvy, but I just knew that I needed to stay connected. And so, yeah, we were literally using fax machines. But back when my dad was racing, he went to Europe and raced.
Telegrams.
And he was ordering parts and engines via telegram.
There's young listeners going, what is this crap these blokes are
What is a telegram?
And telegrams and what is this crap these blokes are on about?
But, you know, a racer, they use their resources today.
Find a way.
Today they find a way. It's, you know, it's engineers and it's CAD software and it's fluid dynamics and all these things that go on. You know, you just use the tools you got at the time. Who would have known the world has gone to where it's gone?
Oh, no one could have predicted that. No way. You know, the moment when I knew you were fully ingrained at Stone Brothers Racing? Was before you'd even raced for them. Do you remember Bathurst 2000?
I do.
You were there in the pits. You'd been signed and announced. Craig Baird was the full-time driver in the Pertec car. Simon Wills was the co-driver. Do you remember Simon Wills having a mishap when he got – I remember walking – not many people know this. It wasn't on telly or anything like that. I'm covering a bunch of teams for the Great Race book, and Stones is one of my teams. I'm walking past the back of the old pits at Bathurst, which have been knocked down and replaced now. I'm pretty sure he – did he spew up in the car or spew up when he got out of the car and you were there to – you helped clean him up. And I went, whoa, you are really ingraining yourself deeply with this team.
Well, everyone ran for the doors. I mean, there was just no one left. The poor guy was just –
Poor Willsie's
he's just
coming out everywhere.
Literally frothing at the mouth and it's in his visor and it's coming down his chin and it's just a mess. And everyone's just – I remember Ross Stowe just looked and ran the other way. I'm like, oh, this poor guy. But actually, I think what had happened was that, you know, he back then there was no cool suits you know, you had the windows wound up a lot of the time and, you know, he probably had a bit of carbon monoxide because that back then they were running the heavy juiced fuel and, you know.
Yeah.
And so Simon,
he wasn't
whether
–
I don't know if he was ill before he got to the pits or if it was a scheduled stop like that, but regardless, he jumped out. He took one look at, at these big eyeballs, ooh, and all of a sudden out she ripped. But I mean, what are you going to do? You're going to help a driver. I felt a lot of, I mean, I felt sorry for him that he was in that position.
Yeah.
But yeah, there you go. I think only you and
stuff.
I know that story. I don't think anyone else wanted to be there.
The good thing was when you came full time the following year, they built you a new car. You didn't have to get the spewy car because that's the one they flogged off to Gibson for Lowndes. So you didn't have to worry about that one.
That was a really tricky weekend because Craig Baird was the Pertec driver and I was already there to take that spot. And so I actually felt very awkward there that weekend.
It's a weird situation.
Because,
it's not
yeah,
a problem, is it?
And so I wanted to be there, but I didn't want to be in the way. I wanted to learn how the team worked and who everybody was. And I didn't want to be respectful to Craig because, you know, he'd had his year, but he wasn't going to be there the next year. And Craig's such a professional. Like, I got a lot of time for Craig Baird because he just carried himself so well during that moment. And he always has done. To me personally. And so that was a bit of a tricky time. And then, you know, you throw the Simon Wills moment in there, it didn't make it any easier.
A few carrot chunks flew at you from his lunch returning. There's so much to cover, and I'm going to race through as many things we can try to squeeze. Bathurst 2001, pole position on debut. And you did something that no one's going to actually beat. Because
what,
remember, it was a top 15.
Stick it in the gravel trap before
the
first
pit stop. I'm talking Saturday. I'm talking Saturday, not Sunday. We'll get to that. But in those days, it was top 15 shootout. Someone had the grand thought that, well, shootouts are great. Let's go from 10 to 15. Shouldn't have done that silly thing. But you qualified 11th.
There you go.
You cannot be topped unless we go back to top 15 shootouts at Bathurst for deepest position to qualify on pole. You're sweet. But you're the second rookie, and no one's done it since as a rookie to take
Bathurst.
And
I haven't got a pole since myself. So I've only had one pole there.
Was the place that just eluded you? Podiums? Like,
surely
you should have got a podium
somewhere. I've only had six races there.
Five with Stones and one with DJs.
With DJs. And so I haven't had many races there. I think that's – if you look back at everybody who does –
guys
have
done 15
or
20.
It's a percentage game.
Yeah.
We've had plenty of chances to win, and I screwed pretty much all of them up.
Which was the one that got away? Which was the best one?
They all got away. The very first one, we were fast. We weren't the fastest car. I probably wouldn't have won it, but I just had no – I had no – turn off switch. I was just full on.
Literally into the pit lane.
Literally full on into the pit lane.
into the sand.
And blew it into the sand. And it's just unfortunate. Like, you know, that sand trap's no longer there. And, you know, we couldn't get it snatched out in time. Mm. We lost a lap. And the whole thing was a bit of a disaster. Felt really bad. I've got to be honest with you. Like, that was one of my lows of my career to do that. Because we had such an amazing first day. But Ross and Jimmy Stone, what amazing people they are. They've never said anything about that.
Mm.
They've never come down on me hard or whatever.
You're the hardest guy on yourself than anyone else.
I'm sure they remember all of it, you know, like it was yesterday, just like I do.
20 years ago this
year. Yeah, and, you know, you get swings and roundabouts, good and bad. That's what motorsport is. And so they're so balanced and have been so gracious with that kind of thing that they've never, you know, they didn't come and say, hey, you're a fool for what you did, which it was foolish. But I just had no off switch. I was just full on all the time. And that's what you do in your rookie year. You do dumb stuff like that. We had 2 years of tyre failures.
I remember that, yeah.
2 years of it, though. I think we blew tyres 2 years in a row there.
I think literally with Paul Will co-driving with you, it blew the guards off it.
It did.
It was that serious, like literally.
We were blowing tyres all day. And that's, again, lack of experience from my perspective. We should have identified that as being an issue going into the race. You know, we had tyre issues at Phillip Island as well. There's high speed. We ran a lot of camber. I loved the speed of the car. I was able to push the car and actually stay loaded to get the benefit out of the big camber that we were running. Just too hard down the straightaways as the car comes up and floats down the straightaway. The inside edge of the tyre just gets hammered and we blew tyres out. We did it the first year. We didn't learn from our mistakes and we did it again. And then we had the Greg Murphy deal and the balaclava gate.
What deal is that? I don't remember that one at all.
You know, and there's Luffy. I heard Luffy telling the story about it the other day.
Hear that on Rusty's pod.
Yeah. And, you know, just such a – what an amazing time. Like, you know.
It doesn't happen like that anymore.
No, it doesn't. And those storylines seem to have gone because everything's just so cookie cutter and so over-engineered and so overthought through that we just don't have those vagaries that creep in.
Yeah.
But every race in Australia, you didn't need to wear a balaclava. This is what people don't necessarily realise. Like the Bathurst 1000 was the only international race in that championship. And so, you know.
Different rules.
The game was on. someone's read the rule book.
Find out who dubbed you in?
We hadn't read the rule book. I don't want to know if you know. I don't need
I've got
to know.
An idea, but I'm not going to say who it is.
It doesn't matter now. And actually, you know, if you have your time again, the boo-boo's on us, not the other way around. I mean, that's just the way it is. Now, you could argue that it's a silly rule that you can race the same car all year, not wear a balaclava, and the one race of the year you have to. Yeah. That being said, it is what it is. But so we messed it up there. And then the DJR Penske deal, Scott Pyle doing such a great job there. He was really flying at home in the race, and we had a failure, and he hurt himself, had a hard hit. And I didn't realise at the time. I just thought, you know, he was just pushing so hard that he made an error, but it was a full mechanical problem. So there's another one gone. There's only one left that I can't remember.
04. I think you finished fifth or sixth or something like that with Greg Ritter. So
there you go.
Yeah, it's kind of – it's the law of averages. The more you go, the more chances you got to have a dip at it. But nevertheless, I don't think it changes your – it'd be nice to have one on your list of achievements.
It would. And look, if I look back at my career and everything, one of those.
To the layman at the pub in Australia, that's the one you
got
to win.
Yeah, I won the Bathurst 1000. Yeah.
I'll have a free beer, thanks.
Yeah, I'll have a beer, thank you.
Luffy talked about that 05 that he was crook, really crook in the lead-up.
Yeah, and he actually
– was there any clue on who might replace him, who you could get? Because at the last minute of the week of Bathurst, your co-driver that you've signed up for the year who's racing and in tune with the team goes down potentially quite ill, and it sounded like he was in a bad way. But
look, I knew he wasn't well. I had no idea how ill he was.
It's probably better that you didn't know.
True, and it also shows you how self-absorbed you get as a driver, that you're really, you know, you're so focused on yourself, you're not even thinking about your teammate. And I didn't know how ill he was. So that's an incredible story, really, and how he's able to bounce back and did an amazing job, by the way. One of the fastest teammates you'll ever get, Warren Luff, just a really great guy. Fantastic driver, great number two for any team down pit lane. That's why, you know, he's still doing those
things. He's still going. Yeah. The best frosted tips in supercar pit lane. Well, but he's got six Bathurst podiums.
No, well, there you go.
Well, he hasn't got a win yet, but he's got lots of twos and threes, and not many people can say that they've got that many. Now, everyone does do the Ambrose Murphy 05. Yeah, whatever. Everyone else does that. Everyone forgets the greatest press conference in the history of the V8 Supercar Championship.
Indy?
From the Gold Coast 2004, where Greg, before he became a television reporter, became one with you alongside. And that was in the era, and I can preface this, in 04. So you've won one championship. You're trying to win number two. You're public enemy number one of every Holden team because you are the head of the Ford monster and everyone's trying to whack you. Steve Richards is trying to beat you. Jason Bright, Mark Scaife, Murph. Tander, they're all lining up. Everyone's taking a swing because you're the guy. You've got car one. That's the go. And Greg got under your skin.
Yeah, he did.
He got you. He got you. He did. And he kept going. He did. And going you. And I think it's on YouTube. I'm not sure, but I'm sure you can find it somewhere online. Everyone's forgotten that one. Everyone talks about Bathurst, but I reckon the Gold Coast was bigger and better.
Yeah, look, the first thing is back to the Mark Scaife and down at Simmons Plains, and we're sitting next to each other, and, you know, how does the fan that remembers what it was like back between 01 and 05, 06?
Yeah, a couple of run-ins, a couple of rounds.
Yeah, and who remembers those times, and how can those two guys sit next to each other and laugh and have a good time? There's a lot of respect between all of us. I'm talking Greg Murphy, the Kelly boys, myself, Jason Bright. I mean, you name it, that era. I think we all respect each other. We've all come from different places to get to that spot. We're all there on merit. You know, we're all taking it super serious. We didn't like each other at the time, and there was a lot of rivalry going on between Ford and Holden.
A lot of money on the line.
A lot of money on the line. There was, you know, I was taking phone calls to, you know, the president of Ford Motor Company during that time. I mean, you know, like, hey, I watched your race on Sunday and I'm so pleased you gave it to that, you know, pinhead, blah, 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 whatever, you know. So, like, yes, we were literally playing for sheep stations. I mean, it was big time back then. It was fantastic to be part of that and experience that. And there was no love lost between, you know, myself and Greg. I think you're right. I think the tipping for me was probably that Gold Coast Indy weekend.
So to paint, it was less Indy.
I'll back it up.
Yeah, you could do it. You could do it. You
know better. The first thing is that, you know, Greg's a real fighter. He's a fantastic driver. He's running, you know, leading his Kmart team and a real contender. Like HRT were right there, but right next to them were the Kmart team, no doubt about it, and Kelly as well, really getting it done, okay? And very formidable force. And so I was spearheading the Ford side, I guess, and Stone Brothers and the Indy track. It's such a intimidating tight place. And we'd been running toe for toe with Greg, and we'd had the Bathurst stuff go on, and so there was, you know, a lot of intensity to it, I guess.
So was now, this where it started, or you two had something going before this, or was it the Gold Coast thing that ramped it? Because the Bathurst crash was the next year.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
So but, yeah, but is this where it sort of started?
It was building. It was building the whole time. And Rick had a problem in the race.
Well, he spun Russell at the first chicane.
Right. And then was it a penalty that got him back
there?
No,
he had a flat tyre. He'd come in and get a tyre change.
Well, he came out and he had a lot of speed. And I was on the lead lap, and I was
– You were the leader.
Leader.
And he was floating around.
He was floating around, and he sort of backed up to make it really hard for me. Wouldn't let me pass. Loud, you know, Greg to catch it. It was a big, big doozy, wasn't it, you know? And so that's really where, you know, it was a really high-pressure situation. I could have binned the car, and I was really frustrated, and I didn't handle myself that well. And so
across the line. Did you jam the brakes?
Oh, well, you know,
bit of
all of that going on, and yeah, that's what it was.
It was the bit we're missing from now.
That's what it was. Yeah. And so, yes, there was already, you know, I mean, I was not liked.
Well, when you win lots.
On the Holden side, for sure, and there was a lot of competition there, and that's how it goes. But that press conference was, you know, quite the thing. And I probably, you know, I was pretty young and not naive, but I didn't really see where it was.
You were like a deer in headlights that day.
Where it was totally coming from. I was unready for it. And, yeah. You know, I probably said a few pinhead things and did a few pinhead things. And, yeah, and I got ambushed pretty good. And he got one over on me, no doubt.
Yeah. That was actually the next day after the Kelly thing, because the Kelly thing was in the day where the races weren't live.
Yeah, see, I've got it all wrong then.
No, you're right. No. The press conference was the following day.
Right.
There was a blow up because I must preface this, and it's wrong if I don't add this in. I was the Kmart PR guy.
Right.
So I was in the garage post race, and you and Rick have words. Right. Murph gets injected. Right. Eric Pender's there. Rob Crawford, the Kmart guys. I'm pulling Rick away because. Yeah. Let's just diffuse this, cool it off. Murray Lomax rings, who's from Channel 10 at the time, later was the head of Supercars, who gave me my telly chance a couple of years later to call supports. We've got to talk to him. You can't not let him talk to us. I'm like, he'll talk to you, but we've just got to just – this is getting a bit too far. Let's just take a little heat out of it for a second. And, of course, I think there was a stewards hearing after that, and there was all sorts of stuff alleged. The heat of sport, the heat of battle, two sides going for it. But the blow up the next day was the press conference afterwards, and it was in the days where it was the Saturday race, all the aftermath. You know, you go off air now on Fox, they analyse it for an hour or so. That wasn't around in those days. So, but yeah, look, that was the height of super. You talked about the '90s and the '90s.
Yeah, that's when
it was at its peak.
I think it was at its peak, and there was a lot of passion there, and it was a different time, different way of going racing, and the Channel 10 covered it differently, you know, and there was a lot of focus on characters of the sport and speaking your mind and, you know, I mean, that's what it was back then, and you don't take any of it back.
I think it's celebrated now. Yeah, it's not a case of, well, it was still no good. I think it stands up to the test of time a lot.
Yeah, like, you know, I think when was it? With the Ingle Scaife
03.
Yeah, so there's that going on. So like that's all part of that whole era.
Yeah. No, definitely. It's it's a press conference that I think someone needs to be interjected into future ones to try to create something that would at least compete with that at
but
some point.
But you know, that all being said, I mean, time's moved on.
Yeah, that's right.
And so, you know, I'm more than happy to, you know, strike up a conversation with Greg and forget in a place where we have a meal, whatever. There's actually no real bad blood left.
It's just what it was.
It's a bit like old VFL days or AFL days. Yeah, you know, it's just that's just what competition was back then, and that's how it was conducted. It was a tough place to be around.
There's a lot on the line. Which of your two Supercars championships are you more proud of? Sort of like picking the best of your kids, isn't it?
Not really. I mean, the era was just fantastic. I've just got a lot of, you know, thanks and gratitude to everyone that was involved in that at the time. I'm the figurehead. I'm the guy who gets to hold the trophy, but it wasn't me that won that championship. It was everybody at Stone Brothers Racing, everybody at Pertec, everybody at Ford. So I think the first one was just amazing, you know, and just that moment at Eastern Creek. I tried to crash a car. I crashed a car heavily on the Friday.
That's right. I remember
and,
that.
And did a whole lot of damage. The guys worked through the night to get it back on track. And we came back and stomped it again the next day. And so, yeah, I tried really hard to mess that weekend up, trying to wreck the car on a wet track at turn one at Eastern Creek. But we got over that, got the championship done. So that to me, has got really fond memories. The second one felt more in control.
Mm. You let it more further.
Yeah, I felt more in control the second one. And then really, you know, the last year, 05, was really, you know, I just didn't do a good job of managing my season. We were fast, but I'm really pleased that Russell was able to win it and keep it inside the team. Mm. So, you know, I look at those 3 years equally the same.
Mm. Even though the last one didn't quite deliver a championship because it did all the other bits. It did to the team.
And so, just, like, you know, the fact that I wasn't the champion, to me, that still makes – it doesn't – yes, I wanted it for my team and my sponsors and so forth, but I still feel very satisfied for that fight. I was only with Stones for 5 years.
Mm.
Okay, so it was only a five-year run, but really super proud of all those 5 years.
And the thing that blows us away, we love the histories of the cars.
Mm.
How many cars did you race in 5 years?
I think
Stones?
Two.
Mm. One AU and one BA. So anyone who loves going, I've got a Marcus Ambrose Purdue car, and I've got a Marcus Ambrose, and I've – well, someone's fibbing.
Yeah.
Because there's not that many of them out there. It's it's a very unique little club. Did Triple Eight ever try to get Marcus
they
Ambrose?
They did. They did early on. So, yeah, Roland came down. Bet Electrical was in it at the time, and I think it must have been 03-ish.
So would you have re-signed for your last 2 years at Stones?
Look, I was –
or did you go a year early on your deal? Were you due to go longer before you left?
Yeah, no. So, look, that was all – you know, that was a funny time, but I was really – I guess that the whole 03, 04, too big for your boots, getting picked on – you know, tough time through the Bathurst thing and everything else. And I thought, geez, you know, if I still think I'm an international driver, which I did, I still viewed myself as somebody that could make it on an international level, a bit like Scott's trying to do now, that there was no better time or I couldn't delay it.
Your stocks are up too and
my stocks,
you know, you're winning stuff.
It's time to make a move. And so, you know, I decided America was going to be it. I needed a break from V8 Supercar. I think that's pretty much what it was. It was like, I can't do this for the next 15 years of my life. It's just, it's too hard. Mm. right. And I just don't have the resilience to withstand it. So, you know, better off to get out than get dragged down.
Mm.
I think that's what it is when I look back at my time. And so I tried to create some opportunities in the States, and that happened, and the NASCAR thing happened. But to do that, I did have to back out of a Ross Stone SBR deal and a Ford deal.
Mm.
So I was on a long-term Ford contract and a long-term Stone Brothers contract. And so both of them were gracious enough to allow me to go. And I remember I had the conversation with Ross. It was actually pre-season. I said, I want to go do this, Ross. And I think Jimmy was in the room. If he was, he was pretty quiet as he normally is.
Well, that's him. That's standard.
And I basically said, look, I want to go do this, and if it's going to be now, you know, it's got now or never for me, if you like. And so he said, look, if you don't want to be here, then there's no point making you stay. And then we just worked our way out of it. And that's how good the Stone Brothers are.
There wasn't pointing at a contract.
We just worked our way out of it, okay? Yeah. And, you know, we're still good friends today, and I really, you know, I've got so much time and respect for them, and I think they do me too, and the whole thing works out great. And same with the Ford Motor Company. And I was part of the Ford thing over in the States with John Szymanski and Dan Derenhoff, who were running Ford Racing in the US at the time. And Edsel Ford was actually, you know, in the background a little bit. He'd met me at Bathurst and sort of knew who I was and what I was all about, and knew he had this Aussie that wants to make it, you know, in America. And so that's how that went down. But that year, it was challenging to get out of those deals. And I wore that through 05, and I think that's part of, you know, the lackluster championship result.
Triple Eight had a sniff, couple of years before that?
They did. So back to that. So, yes, they did. They made some talks. They were very, very new, and they were down the order. They were sort of mid-pack at best, if you like. Max Wilson was driving for them at the time. And so I knew of Roland Dane from my time in the States. I knew of – sorry, my
UK,
time in the
yeah,
UK.
Yeah.
I was racing Formula Ford, following the supercars. Triple Eight were over there winning with their drivers. And so I knew of them. I knew Roland. I knew he was a serious player. So I certainly met them, and we talked about it, and we did exchange offers, but I declined. and we couldn't meet terms. And so then, you know, I really locked my way into to that Stone Brothers run.
Mm. Worked out. It worked out. Was there a chance to somewhere along the line for an FPR wild card at Sydney Olympic Park Homebush, but the wild card thing wasn't a thing? There was no way to officially make it happen, or was that a bit of pie in the sky?
There's been lots of that over the years, and I
you probably had that many. You can't remember.
Yeah, I really can't remember the exact one, but you know, Charlie Swercolt was trying to get me back for a while, you know, and I did seriously consider that early.
So is this kind of in the era he's at FPR, or
it probably was. And then maybe it was. That's
right. Get you back in a Geraldine flavored car, a blue Falcon.
Yeah, that's exactly right. But it was sort of in that time where there was a lot of uncertainty in the States and the Petty thing and so forth, and because Petty were going through bankruptcy with Gillette's, and so you know, I was driving for them, didn't quite know where I was going to go, so I was trying to sort of hedge my bets a little bit. But you know, I'm pleased with the path I took.
No, history shows it worked. It worked out well. I actually can't help but think, watching NASCAR this year, more road courses.
Yeah, a lot more road
courses.
You're
in the wrong era, mate. You could have been banking more wins, and
but that doesn't matter. I mean, my oval stuff was to go oval racing. It wasn't to go road racing. So that was, you know, I really loved my time over there and the oval stuff.
It was cool. Yeah. We could do a whole another chinwag about NASCAR and stuff, but obviously I don't want to blow us out. Maybe we can get together at another stage and do a bit more of that. But I'm also mindful too that Rusty sort of covered a bit of that ground, so I'd like to just do a couple of different things from him over the journey. One of the things that we do a little bit differently is a couple of different things. We've got a great partner of ours, the motorsporttrader.com.au. We call it What's in Your Cupboard. What have you kept from your motorsport history?
Yeah.
Are you a keeper? Are you a hoarder?
I'm not a keeper. I'm not a keeper, and the more – the older I get, the more I wish that I had kept some stuff. But I've always been about the next thing. Here I am, JRM, doing the next thing. So, no, I really haven't kept a lot. You know, there's a few helmets kicking around, a few suits that I didn't get rid of and so forth. But I don't hang anything on the walls per se in the house. I don't have too much stuff going on. You know, my racing and my family life are kind of separate.
Yep.
And so, yeah, I've been a race car driver. I've done it. I've been there. I've experienced it. It's in my head. I remember it. It doesn't need to be, you know, pinned to the wall or sitting in the garage.
Yep. Fair enough. The motorsporttrade.com.au is the place to go if you do want some parts or panels from some other teams.
Just not my house.
If your man cave needs a bit of work, then the guys there will sort you out.
I tell you, there's a bit of stuff here at GRM that
I'm backing the wagon up before I leave. There is stuff here everywhere from 40-odd years of racing. I mean, I'm just looking behind you. There's framed suits, Garth Tander, Scott McLaughlin, Gary Rogers, some lovely frame stuff. There's some nice trophies there. It's a surfboard. I reckon I could fit that in the back of the wagon to take that one back to the office. A couple of things I want to race through before we finish off. I like to play a little game. We keep a track of the stats, Marcus.
Uh-oh.
We keep a track of all the numbers. How much do you think you were fined in your V8 supercar career?
Oh, okay. Let me have a think here.
And then I want you to figure out what you could have bought with that money.
I know that I was forced to write some written apologies to people. That was actually part of some punishments.
Yeah. That's not money, though. That doesn't count.
That's not money. Back then, the fines weren't massive.
Well, you've got a couple of good ones. There's a few good ones.
Well, not as good in the States. I've got a few good ones in the States, too. But I'd say maybe $45,000.
Geez, you've gone overs. $28,250.
There you go. Inflation.
Well, actually, if you do apply it that way, let's see. Do you want to see if these trigger any memories? First ever weekend in a supercar, Albert Park 01, $2,500 for spinning Stephen Johnson. $500 at Eastern
First
Creek.
First of many, I would think. Yeah.
$500 at Eastern Creek in 03 for standing on top of the pit wall after you took pole while a car was still on the track, which I think Tony Cochran said he would pay that for
at the time. That's right.
$5,000. Well, this one wouldn't have gone to you. This would have been a team one from the 04 Queensland 300 wires, the loose wires that the car was excluded, but it kept the win and not the points. And there was a $10,000 fine with $5,000 suspended. So we'll chisel that off you.
I don't even remember that. Was that the 2 tenths box that we had in the car?
Sounds like it.
Yeah, we had
that. Was the weekend
we had a little
of
game we used to play. We used to put a little box in the car with a couple of wires hanging out of it, and it used to be called the 2 tenths box.
Caught a bit of attention, and I think the thanks for the great start, Ken Douglas.
There you
got
go.
A few people rolled. as well. 04 Sandown, $250, late attendance to a driver's briefing. Come on, you should have known better by then. 04, $10,000 for the Rick Kelly post-race, careless driving and not exercising care after crossing the control line at the end of the race.
Well, no care indeed.
$10,000, Marcus. Yeah. That could have been handy right now. And $10,000 in 05 in Perth for contact with Scaife. Which was more for your post-race comments than your –
well, I was still,
you had a good blow-up that day on telly.
That was still a dud deal right there. I got two penalties for the same incident.
You did get stiffed in that race. Yeah. You got a drive-through for the contact in turn then, one with you and Scaife. Yeah, and then I got another, you drove all the way back through the field to like third or fourth.
And then got another.
And they whacked you again post-race,
whacked me again
which
post-race.
I thought was not quite right.
Yeah, and the reason for that was that they couldn't let happen somebody to gain a benefit from someone else's misfortune.
Well, you didn't get a benefit because you got carted through the pit lane and
that's
had to
right.
charge
anyway,
for the next
it
40
is what
months.
It is.
But anyway, there you go. Just a little game we like to play.
We don't forget these things, right? I mean, they get etched in the back of your brain.
We file them away in a database somewhere, mate. It takes us longer to do the fines and the stats for you than it is the cars because you only drove two with Stone. So it's a longer job. National Motor Racing Museum up at Mount Panorama is great friends of ours. They support our couch racer questions. So it's the couch racer questions for the devil racer. See what I did
okay.
there?
Okay, nice.
Fans get to ask questions. Do your best. Peter Alexander says, if testing was a bit more open in supercars in the mid-2010s when you came back, do you reckon you would have – it would have changed anything for you to how it was in the back in the day with more testing?
Oh, yeah, that was definitely an element to it. So there was a lot of things that happened back then. Relocating my family and getting out of NASCAR and getting out of the States was just a huge undertaking, way bigger than I thought. I was very burnt out as well from my time in the States. DJ Penske had a long way to go in their development, and so I wasn't the right person for them with where I'd come from and the pressures that were on me at the time. And so we've talked about this stuff to death, the testing would be an element to it because I never had a chance to even feel comfortable in the car because I had no chance to really get in the car to any degree. So, yes, it's an element, but probably a small part.
Glenn Sansom, I like this. You might not remember it, but it's an interesting one. Do you remember borrowing my manual EF Falcon at Oran Park in 04 for practice starts? The story was Ford couldn't give you a manual
you
media
go.
Car,
there you
and
go.
Ryan, the guy in the Devil Racer mascot outfit, asked if they could borrow my car.
There you go.
So you're using punters' cars to practice your starts.
Why not?
You will stop at nothing, Ambrose.
Now, this is where this nice thanks for the start, Ken, comes from.
Yeah.
So I was a notoriously bad starter. I hadn't really grown up with these big, heavy, powerful cars, and so getting the cars off the line was always a super challenge for me. And Ken came involved in Stone Brothers Racing.
Ken Douglas. Long-time racer himself.
Long-time racer himself, a bit of a guru.
Yep.
And so we would actually go out pre-race and drive out of the track somewhere that we weren't going to get jammed in traffic and take a manual car, preferably a V8, and go and practice starts just to sink in the technique. Pre-race. And so that's why I was thanking Ken for the starts, because he would come out with me and we would roll through it. And we had a little box and we had a little timing sequence.
Yep.
And we were doing it. And so
no one else would be doing that.
No.
No one else would have thought
but,
of that.
You know, but it was Ken, not me, but I was battling with the starts and I was that's how we did that. Mm. And so
love it.
Very nice.
Thanks, Glenn.
How amazing that Glenn would let someone borrow their car to go do practice starts and burn out a clutch.
Imagine the clutch smell after that. Jesus. Be stoked. Got it. As driven by M. Ambrose. Andrew Walker's question, what impact did Jeff Pilates, the late Jeff Pilates, have on your early supercars career, and what's your best memory of him?
A lot.
One
of the good guys at Ford and a real racer. He'd been very successful in business. He came in and was during when you look back at it now, a great business for Australia, and you've got a lot of time for Jeff Pilates, a lot of great memories, just like Howard Marsden, similar era. Just sad to see them not here today.
Yeah, absolutely. Really put Ford, Ford got the checkbook out because they'd not really got it out beforehand.
That's right. And there were pressure points where, we were dealing with win on Sunday and they were tracking sales on Monday. That was really happening back then. Mm. And they were very engaged with the Falcon and they really loved the race program to get it back to its winning ways. They saw the wave of V8 V8 Supercar, and they wanted to be part of it. Didn't want to be left behind, I think, is probably more the point. And Jeff was definitely involved in there early on, no doubt about that. And, you know, and Howard Marsden and so forth around that era.
How ingrained it all was then, where the manufacturers were so heavily involved. My wife worked at Ford around that era, you were winning championships in her much younger career. And she did regale to me the story that at the time you must have recorded a phone message that everyone that rang Ford got, hi, this is Marcus Ambrose, Ford V8 Supercar champion.
Thanks
for
your help.
They don't do that stuff anymore.
How awesome's that?
It's cool. Yeah. Someone's probably going to think
we would go. Yeah, we would go down to the Ford Motor Plant and walk through the plant. Mm. We would go and shake hands and meet the people that were building the Ford Falcon. Mm. I mean, just awesome, really, when you think about that. And Australia's lost so much when you think about all that manufacturing that's gone. What a disaster.
Don't make me cry. Mm. Don't make me cry. Carl Matthews, do you still keep in contact with any of your NASCAR fellow drivers, teammates, competitors, or crew members?
Yes and no. Yes and no. Look, I've touched a lot of people in motorsport, and so it's really hard to stay connected with everybody. And that big body of water across there does make it a challenge. So I follow them. I email from time to time, but I haven't been back to the States since I left. I was going to go back this year, last year. It's not going
to
happen anytime soon.
Stuff that up for a bit, yeah.
So yeah, it is what it is. But I do follow the sport closely, and I do stay in contact with a few, not all, because it's just it is kind of too hard. But yeah, let's face it. Facebook and Insta and all these things, you can track people, stay in touch with people. People know what we're up to, so it all works.
Chris Morley, what's Richard Petty like behind the scenes? Seems like a bloody good bloke.
Yeah, Richard is one of the nicest guys you'll ever meet. I've got so much time and respect for the Petty family and Richard himself. I mean, he's not the first Petty. His dad was the original Petty, and there's been five generations of Petties involved around motorsports at a professional level and trying to make it now. Just amazing, really, and just such a humble guy, quite a spiritual guy. He taught me an awful lot about life and about racing and how to conduct yourself. And so, you know, I'm just lucky to have known him and to have driven for him and to be around that whole thing, because he really is a legend. And I've been around a lot of great people, but, you know, Richard's really – yeah, top of the pile.
In America, Petty STP 43 is kind of Brock Mobile 05.
It is.
It's
very much that case,
big time. Heath Crook, there's some cash for you and I to divvy up out of this. How come Pye took over from you when you came back from NASCAR? Did you not have what it takes? $100, this goes unanswered. Well, $50 each, Marcus.
We'll take your cash. Yeah, we'll take your cash. Well, Scott was actually driving for DJR, and so I was replacing Scott. But they kept Scott on because he was out of a ride to then do the enduros. So I came back into the sport. Dawned on me pretty quickly that, you know, I wasn't going to be right to lead them where they needed to go, and didn't have the time, didn't have it in me, basically. And so the straight answer was to say, I need to get out of the car, and I think your best thing to do is to put someone who's been driving this car back in it. And that's what they did with Scott Pye, and they put him straight back in, and he led the team forward, and, you know, he had his good run with them, and he's still a great driver, doing great things today. He's just never quite, you know, made that big leap to championship serious contender, but he may still do that. I'm a good friend of Scott's, and I've got a lot of time for him, and I appreciate everything he did to get back in the seat and keep going.
I'll take 25, you take 75.
No,
that's
no,
fair
we'll
deal.
Share
that's
it. Fair deal. Split it down the middle.
Heath, cough up. I'll send you the bank account details. Todd Jones, I should say. In your first in supercars, was there a reason you always wore a helmet without a visor on it?
We don't need one. You don't need
a
visor, Todd. You got a windscreen. So I like the full face because there is extra protection there. But you don't need the double glare, if you like. If you've got a visor, you're hot anyway and steam's an issue, and then you've got the window. So now you run a visor down because you've got cooling in your helmet. So back when I first started V8 Supercar.
Back in my day,
they actually ran the windows down at the Pistol 500. That's as good as you got, but like terrible for aero. They soon worked out, oh, no, we've got to have the windows up for the aero profile. Yeah. So they then had to start working on getting the drivers cool.
Dave Parker, do you think you're accepted in the NASCAR paddock At what point did you feel like that you were, if so, if you were?
Yes, I did feel accepted in the NASCAR paddock. I think you can't get to the Cup Series and not belong. And so by the time you get there, whether you're first or 43rd on the grid, there's 43 cars on the track over there, everyone respects each other because it's a lot of effort and a lot of skill to get there, no matter where you end up on that grid. So, yes, I did feel belonged and I felt part of it and I felt respected. That's all great. But you're only as good as your last race in NASCAR, right? And so you don't last there if you don't perform. Mm. And so you get kicked out and kicked to the curb. And so to be in the Cup garage for as long as I was, I think, you know, makes me feel good today about that and that I survived it, right? Mm. So, you know, a lot of guys come in and don't last more than a few races and they get kicked out. And teams, they'll tell you over there, you don't need to prove you can, you need to prove you can't.
Mm.
So as soon as you've proved that you can't get it done, you're out.
Gone. See ya.
You're out.
Doors that way.
Yeah, so that's really how it works over there. It's just doesn't matter what you look like, how old you are, male, female, from Australia, from Argentina, it doesn't matter.
You've got to deliver. You get results.
And look at the guys that are in there right now. You know, Cole Larson, that's just so great to watch him come through and see what he's doing right now. He's there just on talent.
Mm.
And just great to see them make it all the way to the top.
I was going to mention this sort of – I'm adding my own question in here, but from what, 06 trucks, Xfinity, Cup, a bunch of – you did so many races over there. Is it all a blur?
It is a blur.
Because you couldn't pinpoint a specific year, race, car.
It is a blur, and your brain can only handle so much. Yeah. That's why I sort of got that O3, O4, O5 Bathurst versus Indy wrong. Because it does blend in after a while. Like you're talking sort of 50 races a year in the States.
Testing, 10 years. Appearances, media,
duties,
flying backwards and forwards between doing two series one day.
We did one weekend. It was at Michigan. I was with Carl Edwards and Trevor Bayne.
Was this the Montreal one?
Yeah, it literally was planes.
Trains and automobiles.
Pretty well. We had helicopters in there and speedboats to get to and from the track.
Oh, because Montreal, you're on the water, aren't you?
Yeah, yeah. So we literally jumped out of Carl Edwards, out of the Michigan on Saturday, a 2 mile big super speedway, not super speedway, speedway. Roger Penske owns it now. One of the best tracks you'll go to. Mm. Fantastic crowd. We left there, practice. I think it was about 10:30, 11 o'clock, the practice finished. Jumped in Carl's jet. He flew it with his race suit on.
He flew it with his race gear on.
Me and Trevor jump in the back. We seal the door down. We're flying over to Montreal. And Carl, you know, he's such a great guy. He's pretty loose. And he turns over to us about three quarters of the way across. He said, we're doing really good. We're in Canada now. He said, but I've just realized we've got no permission to land because they're doing the air show for the race at Montreal. And so they closed the airspace
so
they could do the air show pre-race. So we got exemption to get in there. Then we had a helicopter on the ground, flew us to the track from the airport. But the helipad was actually at the end of the rowing complex. So it was
Hosted the Olympics.
They host the Olympics there. Yeah. So the pits were down one end and the helicopter pad was up the other. So they got a speedboat wakeboard boat to wakeboard us to the cars, which were on the grid.
Ready to race.
And the lady was doing the anthem. I mean, you know, talk about cut it fine. And jeez, that day, I actually won that day. Carl had a decent day, but a tough day. And Trevor got himself a lot of carbon monoxide poisoning. And so he spent like 4 hours in the medical center. So we couldn't fly home.
You had to wait for him.
Yeah, we had to wait for So I'm sitting around with the trophy. I've got no one to celebrate with. I just want to go home and get ready for the race next day. Anyway, we flew, into international borders again, got home, and we did the Michigan race the next day. And that's just how
Just how it's got to be. Adam Blattman, can you briefly, in a nutshell, describe racing a super speedway, Talladega, Daytona, either or, with cars beside, in front, behind? You talked about this amazingly. I remember vividly at a DJR teammates night some years ago. It is unfathomable in any other form of the sport where you are so on knife edge and you could be brought completely undone by something that you don't do. But can you encapsulate that feeling?
Super speedway racing is the only races that I'd always make sure that my wife and kids were at.
Yeah.
Like I just made sure that I didn't matter what it cost or what happened, I wanted them there before the race started.
Because a deliberate decision to do
that because of the potential. I just wanted to say, you know, goodbye. Not goodbye, but I wanted them there.
So if anything did happen, it's not like they're learning on television.
I wanted them to be right there because those days I did the first one and it was a NASCAR Truck Series race at Talladega and Derek Cope got turned from the bottom into the fence coming into turn three. He hit that hard that he snapped the Hans device in half.
Ooh.
Right? And I went under his car. So it was
while he's
was,
in midair.
Whilst he was midair doing his thing. And, you know, I just remembered from that moment on, I don't like these races. These
Fair
races
point.
Aren't fun, but you've got to do them. Okay. So
you can't be all the
drivers,
driver
I think
them.
All yeah. the drivers at that level, you know, they just get through those days. I mean, we put it all on the line. But a lot of the stuff that happens is out of your control. So you're in a 43 car pack. The car is designed to be running in a pack. So they restrict the motors down to about half the normal horsepower. So they all run in a big wad, and the lead car breaks the air. The car at the back has no air on it and can push the pack forward. It's called pack racing. So you'll be in the middle of the pack, you know, 43 cars in the field, and you four wide at Talladega on the straights, maybe three wide in the corners. You can squeeze four wide. Say you're in the middle of the whole deal. Well, you actually can't see out your window because the car in front is hiding the view, and the car in front of him is hiding the view, and the car in front of him is hiding the view. You can't see out the side of you because the cars are right there. And you look in the mirror, and there's a bloke hitting you the whole time. And then the cars are just floating. It's like being on an ice rink because there's no air on the cars. They're designed to be low drag, and so they've got no weight on the wheels. And so the cars are literally floating, and you can spin the wheels, you know, on the straightaways.
It's like pushing an air hockey table. Of,
yeah.
You know, you push your cable.
It's unbelievable. So the cars are constantly buffeting and moving around, and you put some steering into the car and it doesn't do anything. You're just kind of going with the flow. And if something happens in front of you, you're in the crash. I mean, you don't even know it started. You have a spotter, a guy who's standing on top of the grandstand, and he's talking to every driver has one, and they're talking you through what's going on in front of you, behind you, around you, because you just can't see. And so you're trying to predict what's going on. And so the big crashes that happen, you're literally in them and you don't know what direction you're going. You could be backwards,
it's
sideways,
like a washing machine.
All of a sudden you're in the fence, you don't know how the fence got there, where'd the fence come from, you're in the fence, you know. And that's just literally how it is. And so you just get knocked and hammered around. But When the days are, that's what it was like back then. They've changed the rules slightly. Each year they move it around a bit so the cars sort of react slightly differently. But that's what it was like back then. It really was, you know, quite incredible to be part of that. Extremely dangerous. You know, that they're not to be taken lightly. I think the modern drivers today, you know, they haven't been around the non-safer barrier tracks. They haven't been around where they have the inner tire inside the big tire. And so the old drivers, the generation before me, who were part of that, the Jeff Gordons and Tony Stewarts and so forth, you know, they had a lot of respect for the super speedway stuff. I think now with the new generation of drivers coming through, they haven't had it like it used to be, where the walls were a lot harder to hit. And so you just see them taking more chances. So I'm actually pleased I'm not doing it right now.
Yeah, no, good call. Dale Rogers, who was your PR man.
Yeah,
your
good
time
old Dale.
DJR, Team Penske. Is the Rudy Hill RSL the best venue to eat on race weekends?
Oh, come on
Why
now.
Would he ask this?
Yes, no. So Dale and I are very good friends. And when I came back from the USA.
He used to run Revolution Race Gear, remember?
He did.
Too,
and he sponsored me back in the Formula Ford days, 96, 97.
The logo would have been on the website.
He was. It was on the website. And so we go back a long way, really good friends. We went to Bankstown and we sat at the Rudy Hill RSL for our very first Penske test, official test, in January of 2015.
15, yep.
And there was this Commodore with like a purple panel and a white panel and a red panel and the whole deal. And I just so happened to watch Howzo's the night before, right? So like all of a sudden we have this game about, oh, it's all Howzo's and this and that and everything else. And that's the fun and games. That's the real Australiana, which I kind of like. Well, I actually kind of like that side of Australia.
It's cool.
And I've got a lot of time for Rudy Hill, the RSL, and everyone who goes there.
Down the road from Sydney Motorsport Park. Yeah. It's a common accommodation venue for those racing at SMP. Last question on our National Motor Racing Museum catch race questions. In regards to the museum too, with all the things with COVID and things going on, in terms of opening times and the things that you've got to do or not got to do there, museums, Bathurst website, supplies, or their Facebook page. I thought I'd just throw that in there before we get to the last one. Ron Swanson on Twitter, advice for a talented young karting driver when the chips are down and they want to give up. What does Marcus say?
Just get your chin out of the gravel and move on to the next one, right?
Nice.
Not every day is a good day. You know, and it's persistence that pays off in racing. You can just got to be stubborn. Mm-hmm. You got to be persistent. You got to believe in yourself and just keep going, right? Racing is 90% frustration, 10% jubilation. There's not much in between. You're either on top of the world or you're digging yourself out of the fence.
It's 90 or 10 and nothing in between. So there you go, Ron. Pass that one on to the youngster that may need that little bit of advice. By the way, how old are your girls now?
They're 13, 15. So Tabitha's 15, Adelaide's 13. They're both kart race. Adelaide's just got off a P plate, so she's excited about that. She's been approved. And, yeah, we just have a bit of fun with it down in Tasmania. It's a great sport for the family to be involved in. I came up through karting. I've got a lot of time and respect for what it did for me and where it took me. Whether you become a professional driver or just, you know, just grow up as a person. It's just a great community to be around. So I support karts. I like karts. We don't do it at a national level. We're doing it at a club level, and that's just the way we like it.
Yeah. Yep. Sounds good. To finish off with, you're a guru at the top 10 shootout format in supercars. Mm-hmm. We have our own top 10 shootout, which is just a really fancy way of saying word association. I've got a list of 10 things.
Okay.
You tell me the first word that comes to your brain on each.
This could end badly.
It could, but we can edit it. We can edit it. It's okay. And you can't use the same word twice.
Okay.
Or if you need multiple words, we'll put a hyphen between them all, and it's one word. Okay? I'll let you off the hook. A couple of these people you have spoken about, you might be able to encapsulate them now in a word. Ross Stone.
Just a great guy.
All right. You got one great guy. Russell Ingall.
A grafter.
Grafter. I was going to say King of Contra, but, you know, I think everyone knows that. Mark Scaife.
Respect.
Daytona.
Awesome.
Richard Petty.
Legend.
Ryan Story.
A mystery.
Oh, that's a good one. Like it. Roger Penske.
Roger Penske is just an absolute professional.
Professional. There's your word. There's your word. Gary Rogers.
A racer.
Mm, fair point. One to go. Trans Am.
Growing. I think it's a category that's growing. I don't think it's quite right. I think that it's where racing could go in Australia. I think it's the most bang for buck you'll ever get. I'm a big fan of it. And I think what TA2 have done and the Trans Am have done, two separate series, but able to share the same cars, give guys the ability to race more often.
State level, national.
Yeah, and a budget class, basic race car with too much power, not enough brakes, and not enough tyre. Perfect.
Sounds good. Mate, you've survived the top 10 shootout. No dings in the wall, no touches with the fence. you've safely crossed the line. No fines being added to your tally. Mate, really appreciate the time. Love to see what's going to happen in the future with you and GRM, the TV stuff. Mm. Kids in karting, it's great to see some more of you.
To the sleuth, thank you very much. It is great to be back talking to you, and we've got a lot of history from the past. It's actually fun to reconnect and talk about it a little bit. Who knows what the future holds for me. I'm juggling a bit of an act between one foot in supercars and one foot over at GRM. I'm enjoying the dance. It's been fun. I've got the kids growing up. I just want to enjoy life. We've had a lot of things to be miserable about over the last couple of years, haven't we, as a country? And I'm just looking forward to, you know, over time here, hopefully sooner rather than later, getting back to the track, enjoying life, enjoying the great things about Australia, and just live the dream.
A huge thank you to Marcus Ambrose. Wasn't he great? Candid, open, honest, fun. Really great chat. Really appreciated the time with Marcus that we spent at GRM, and really cool. I hope you enjoyed that. We would have loved to have chatted for a longer period of time, but he's got so much to do at GRM. To get that hour was crucial and important, and to get any more would have just been a bit too hard. So no doubt down the track when the time opens up in the future, we might be able to have another go and go round two, part two with Marcus. Hope you've enjoyed it. Don't forget to please jump on our website. It is bookshop.v8sleuth.com.au. Father's Day is on the run-up. There's all sorts of specials. We've got new products coming online. Don't forget, we talked about in the pod about him driving the Elcair air conditioning car. That's covered in our Perkins Engineering book. That'll be out in a couple of months' time. It's coming together really well. And, of course, don't forget, Marcus, two-time winner of the Adelaide 500 back in the mid-2000s. You can get a copy of Sensational Adelaide. It's our brand-new book. covering the full history of the Adelaide 500. It's 400 pages. It's a hardcover Big Bertha. It's a perfect Father's Day present. Or if you just want to buy yourself a present, why not? Early Christmas, early birthday, whatever you've got to do to justify it in your own mind, grab a copy. We've had great feedback and sensational support. Bunch of new DVDs from the archive of Seven Sport as well. Make sure you jump on the website. There is something for everyone at the V8 Sleuth online bookshop. Our regular site, v8sleuth.com.au, bunch of news, bunch of articles, bunch of cars for sale, bunch of stuff to look at there. And of course, follow us on all the socials, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. You know the deal. Anyway, we're done for another edition of the V8 Sleuth podcast powered by Repco. Join us every Tuesday as we recap the latest in the Repco Supercars Championship on Repco Supercars Weekly. But in the meantime, that's me signing off. Hope you enjoyed this chat with Marcus Ambrose. We'll have another edition next Wednesday, so tune in to find out what it will be. Chat to you then.